Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I am Joe Kirk and I am joined as ever by Phil Brining. Good afternoon, Phil.
Good afternoon. How are you, Joe?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Very well. We are without Jasmine Harrison this week, so it is just me and thee. How did you find the session went, Phil?
I thought it was good, actually. Again, I do this every week, Joe. It's amazing how time flies. I was thinking, sitting there thinking, right, just jumped on, just started, hope we've got enough to talk about today. And then it was like 25 past one. I'm thinking, I haven't talked about half the stuff I need to talk about.
Yeah, I was slightly worried as well that we were going to burn through the topics because we're trying to put a bit of a different focus, aren't we, on the GDPR radio sessions as opposed to flying through 30 different news pieces.
Yeah,
we're trying to constrain it to four or five and digging a little bit deeper. But then that does kind of run the risk, doesn't it, of if we dig deep but get through it quite quickly, we could end up not really having stuff to talk about. But that was not an issue at all this week, was it?
Well, there's always things to talk about. But I mean, I wanted to try and, you know, focus in on bits of the PECA because we've been doing an audit and you know, a lot of interesting stuff's come up about, you know, email marketing and cookies. And we had some great conversation about cookies. Yeah, it's just that you know, these are topics that there's lots to talk about, isn't there? I mean, you talked about transparency and the Experian ruling and quite a lot of things we covered.
Yeah, the good thing about data protection is that often most of it kind of intertwines with each other, doesn't it? And that was kind of what made today's session flow quite nicely, was that we started with kind of FISA and the DPDI bill and the IPA, which is the Investigative Powers Act that's just come through new legislation in the UK, and then kind of intertwined into transparency and then what that means, you know, as you mentioned, in relation to PECA. So yeah, I thought it was a really good session. I really do always enjoy kind of talking about PECA and cookies, and it's well timed with the projects that me and you were kind of in the middle of. So yeah, I thought it was a really good session.
No, that's good. Yeah, and I did open up that. I've got it open on my screen right here that Steph recommended. It's the transparency opinion from the European Data Protection Board, which again, it's all good stuff to read this kind of stuff into. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, me too. And it just strengthens your knowledge, doesn't it, around, you know, data protection and kind of what transparency actually means. Because as I'm sure many listeners know, that data protection law is quite grey, isn't it? It's, you know, they leave it open to interpretation, which makes our job a hell of a lot more difficult. But
yeah, I think my favourite part of the session was, again, Steph's brilliant observations about cookie policies, cookie notices and cookie tools. I think really just kind of, for me, knife through butter, right? Bing, lights came on. That was great. But then you're then extending that into, well, if you fold that back into this transparency opinion, you know, then your cookie notice has got to be like, you know, massive.
Or it could be. Yeah. But without going into too much information and ruining the session, we will let you dive in and we'll see you next week.
Which I didn't manage to do. I finished one off yesterday, and we're going to finish that cookie one off today. So, it's been quite good. I've had one of my third screen's been on the blink, and I've had IT on my laptop hours trying to sort it out. Anyway, it all transpires that just the power supply wasn't powerful enough. It suddenly stopped working. I assumed it was a Windows update that kind of stopped it all working. But for whatever reason, it just kept flashing on and off. It was really
not
irritating.
Ideal.
Yeah. But I fixed it now. I bought a new power supply, 5-amp power supply, plugged it in, and the job is a good one.
Ready and raring to go.
Yeah, how's your week been?
Yeah, my week's been pretty similar, apart from the power issues. We've been working together, haven't we, on our cookie audit project that it's been going on for a number of months now, hasn't it? You know, we've run into a few complications with the tool that we're using to scan cookies on the website.
Yeah, we can talk about that. Hopefully we can talk about that during the card. We talk about that in a bit. Not going to cut you off, Joe. Carry on.
No, it's all right.
Cover that off, won't we, later on?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but that has been kind of my main focus this week because, you know, we wanted to get it done, and I've started into the next phase of a Roper project with one of our customers. That's kind of, so we've built the Roper, but there's some gaps in there due to, you know, people not quite understanding or knowing the answers to some of the questions. So off the back of that, I've myself and Rofi have created a risk register that's kind of identified the gaps or potentially where wrong lawful bases have been chosen. And the next phase of the project is going to kind of involve meeting back with the key stakeholders at the organization to kind of, you know, pick back through those and make sure that it's the information that's on there is as accurate as possible. So, yeah, very, very good. Long piece of work, but it's going to be worth it in the end. So,
yeah. Well, I spent Monday morning. I went down to got invited down to a client in Leeds, actually, to go and sit in on their staff training, which was really good. So do you know Jason now? This don't Jason's a good,
I do.
Good
yeah.
great guy. Good contact of ours. Anyway, he said, look, I'm doing this training. I'm in Leeds doing this training. You know, why don't we catch up for lunch or something afterwards? So I said, yeah, that's a great idea. He said, well, actually, why don't you come and see on the training, which I did. But it was really good, unsurprisingly, you know, and it was really good because everyone was engaged with it. And it was really nice to see that kind of data protection training thing in action in another organization. It's very good. So that started the week off well, although I have to say I spent all Friday out last week because we had our party and all Monday out this week, so I was doing that and I felt completely snowed under for the rest of the week.
That's great. Sorry, I was listening. I've had Vipex screaming down my ears for the last 2-3 minutes. So I've tried closing the window so it doesn't impact me for the next hour. But I don't know. If Rob, if you're listening, can you pick up the phone, please?
he won't.
I'm sure he's not here. I'm sure he's getting some lunch. But
things that I wanted to talk about today, and I mean, everyone can talk about whatever they want, but I was wanting to kind of cover off a bit more on Pekka, because I had Esther on the phone yesterday just talking through a scenario with email marketing in a business context, and that kind of relates to our cookies, which we want to talk about as well, don't we? I think I wanted to talk about, touch on some bits in the news, like, you know, the FISA, the DPDI, the Investigatory Powers Act, you know, all kind of related a little bit. There was some new legislation connected to the internet. I thought we talked about that last week a little bit. And then maybe a little bit about, kind of linked in a way to what Esther was looking at, Article 14 and transparency and privacy information. So they're kind of the crunchy topic to get into. What have you got on your wish list of things to talk about?
Well, I'm quite happy to talk through most of that, to be honest, because it's interesting stuff and it's really relevant, isn't it? Especially the cookie compliance stuff. I've seen a few news pieces, but they're not really kind of chunky pieces. They're kind of just headline stuff. I saw that the ICOs fined two companies a total of £330,000 for making aggressive and unwanted marketing calls. So Outsource Strategies Limited and Doctor Telemarketing Limited, they made 1.43 million unsolicited calls to individuals registered on the UK's telephone preference service. A hell of a lot, yeah.
That's a lot of people. I didn't the TPS was that, that big.
That many people, yeah. Well, it was done in a span of 30 months. I'm not sure on what the maths is, but that's a hell of a lot of calls, isn't it, in a day?
Well, it's a lot of calls. If 1.43 million of them were to TPS customers, you know, unless they've specifically targeted TPS customers, which you obviously wouldn't do that, but it just seems a lot of calls, doesn't it? That's a big volume.
Yeah, that's a good point, that. So, yeah, they're probably not doing the pre-screening checks, are they?
Which, well, might be 100 million calls, you know.
Yeah, and 1.4 on the TPS. Yeah. It is a lot of calls, isn't it? And again, we talk about this, don't we, quite often when we come across stories like this. It's kind of, for the organisation, does the reward outweigh the risk? So you could get fined. I think one of the companies was fined 240,000 and the other one was fined £100,000 for the calls. But if those 1.43 million calls, you know, results in
£1 million worth of work. Yeah,
so exactly. Like, it's worth it.
£250,000 profit might be at 25% or 20-25% net profit ratio, might be £1 million of turnover. So it's quite feasible that could be done. It makes you wonder who's making the calls. I mean, I know it's a machine, but it might be Rob Wilkinson. You know, he's like a machine. He's like a robot, isn't he?
That's why he's hammering down the calls.
Rob,
yeah.
Robot Wilkinson.
God, you've not cracked one of your poor jokes on here for a long time, Phil. That did make me laugh. While we're on the topic of fines, I saw that the ICO also fined YMCA. The news article that I read called it public sector mates rates, they said, for a GDPR violation. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I've not seen any other in the news. I believe this could be the ICO's first fine for a breach of the GDPR in about 17 months, because they didn't do one at all, did they, last year?
Surely not.
I know that for a fact, and I haven't seen one so far this year. Happy to be corrected to any of the listeners that are listening in, but yeah, that could well and truly be one of the first fines they've made in 17 months. And the fine, it came about, the people at the YMCA had sent an email that had 264 emails that were sent to addresses in the copy rather than the blind copy facility, and it revealed identities of 166 individuals on a HIV support program. The fine was reduced from 300,000, sorry, in line with the ICO's public sector approach. And I actually came across a piece, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with John Baines. I'm connected with him on LinkedIn, and he kind of questioned the ICO and, you know, why have they pulled the fine down from 300,000 when the YMCA aren't public sector? And the ICO said that, as a central YMCA is a charity that does a lot of good work, they engaged with us in good faith after the incident happened, recognised their mistake immediately and have made amends to their protest activities, and they paid the fine in full straight away. We applied the spirit of the public sector approach to them, even though they're not strictly a public sector body. So John followed up, you know, with some questions and kind of said, you know, why have you reduced the fine? The further response was that the point was that they engaged fully and subsequently paid the fine in full, thus confirming our position that they were engaging and taking the breach seriously. The calculation comes before the payment, which was no bearing on the assessed amount. And John said, and you're not quite sure what to make of this, kind of saying around the idea, you know, can any controller which does a lot of good work and engages with the ICO in good faith, you know, warrant a 3,900% decrease in a fine that was originally the recommended sum?
It's interesting, because they fined, I don't think it is a first GDPR fine, because they fined HIV Scotland back in 2020, £10,000, but that is a public authority for the same thing, for a breach, actually a breach under Section 155 of the Data Protection Act 2018, and Article 83 of the GDPR, according to what I'm reading on the ICO's website. And that was the same type of thing. But interestingly, back in 2016, i.e. prior to the GDPR, the maximum fine was £500,000. The sexual health clinic, Dean Street, 56 Dean Street, got fined £180,000. That was for 800 patients, data breach. So, you know, I agree what the people are saying on here, you know, like, charities closer to public sector, but not public sector, and private sector probably getting no leeway at all.
Yeah, and Janine's left a comment saying, so as long as you say you're sorry, you can do what you want. And I think that's kind of what John was questioning. It sets a bit of a dangerous precedent, doesn't it? Kind of rewarding people for cooperating with you off the back of a breach, when that's just the duty of an organisation, surely. If you've infringed the UK GDPR, then, you know, you should have a duty to make amends. And I don't think that should be rewarded by reducing your fine.
Well, they've just published their fines policy, haven't they? And they said they were taking into account eight things, one of which was the cooperation with them. And if you don't cooperate, I didn't know there was a discount for cooperating, much more of a premium added if you don't cooperate. But maybe they are going to discount for cooperating.
Yeah, or just a one-off in this case. The chat's a little bit lively. Is there?
I'm going back to the TPS. I mean, the TPS technically is free, I believe, because we have used it in the past for looking up individual numbers, haven't we, before we've placed calls, which is a long-winded way of doing it. But that is a free service. But what we do now is we pay a subscription to have our data basically linked and updated with unsubscribes. And that's the easiest way of doing it. You either screen your data before you do a campaign, or you keep it live linked, you know, so that any subscriptions or unsubscribes get notified if they're on your database. But yeah, I think technically it is free, but I'm not sure if you can download it free and then load it into your own database system to do that kind of suppression management. But I know that there are routes to getting numbers individually checked and not have to pay for it. But it's a long-winded way if you're making a million calls.
Yeah, that would take a hell of a lot of time and a lot longer than a year. But yeah, shall we move into the chunkier pieces that you wanted to cover off?
Let's just so that's interesting on the fine. A couple of things I saw in the news as well, Joe, was that the Verizon 2024 data breach investigations report has been published, which are downloaded. I was interested that you can either submit your personal details and download a copy, or read it online without submitting your personal details. So that's, I think, the first time they've given that choice.
Yeah, funny enough, I saw that, and I almost left a comment on here about kind of when I was doing some notes about, you know, why do they feel they need to know my name, full name, and
well, it's for marketing
the company I work for.
Yeah, and for marketing purposes. Yeah.
Well, exactly that, and I was thinking, well, that's not really kind of it didn't sit right with me, but I guess the alternate thing is that I don't get to read the report. So I thought it's a bit of a moot point,
this
isn't
is
it?
Consent or pay. We're going to come on to this, aren't we? This is effectively the same as consent or pay. You know, give us your details to download our report you want to read.
Yeah.
And consent to us approaching it, or don't read the report. That's not really proper consent, is it? But anyway, now that you can view it online, it seems to be a cut down version that you can view online, because I did submit my personal details and download, because it's a good report to read.
Yes.
What was interesting? Well, interesting. I mean, there's. I mean, I noticed 68% of all the breaches. So they've surveyed something like 30,000 breach incidents in 94 different countries. So it's quite a big population.
Yeah.
And 68% of the breaches involved non-malicious human element, i.e., kind of social engineering type of approach. Which is a very large proportion, 32%. So there's a little bit of crossover in these stats. I don't all up to 100%. 32% involved ransomware. 28%, which is a bigger aspect, was errors. And 15%, which is another real big worrying stat, is breaches involving a third party or supplier. Again, that's not really any surprise, is it?
No. Yeah, we've spoken, haven't we, on here a few times about kind of organizations having a breach, and it's not necessarily due to their kind of incompetence, it's the supply chain, isn't it, further down. I can't remember who it was. There was quite a big one, wasn't there, recently. We've spoken about it on here before, and I'm sure I know you know of it, but I'm not sure if you
I'm not clocked yet.
You're not clocked on. I can't remember who it was.
Plums, cherries going round and round.
We've spoken on here before though about quite a big breach, and it wasn't due to the organization, the controller, it was the processors further down the line who kind of, it was one of the, I can't remember, I'm really sorry.
I didn't get three cherries or bars, whatever. But the other thing is that 14% of all the breaches involved an initial exploitation of vulnerabilities as an initial step. So, you know, that is kind of the route into all the breaches. But I was interested in another stat, in that the phishing, there's a graph that shows an phishing incidents, which is going up, you know, quite significantly, but going up faster than the phishing incidents is the incidence of not clicking, which means, hopefully, fingers crossed, we're getting the message across, you know, that if you get a phishing attack, you know, there's more people that aren't clicking on them now in this report than that are clicking. So the graph is diverging. So the non-clickers are kind of accelerating, which again was a good stat to see.
Yeah, that's positive, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure we've all been caught out by phishing once or twice. I know I have. I probably shouldn't own up to this, but I think one of my first weeks of joining DPP, an email landed in my inbox that was supposedly from one of our directors, and he asked for my mobile number because he had a job he needed me to do. And I was very naive, went on there and left my number, and the only thing I got was just a text, and that was it. But yes, it is good that the number of people who aren't now clicking on phishing emails is rising, as opposed, and there's a decline in those that are clicking on the email. So that's definitely good to see.
Positive news. Now, what did you make? You wanted to talk, I think, or at least mention Conservative MP David Davis having a moan about the DWP plans to monitor bank accounts. Now, I think that kind of is a little bit loosely related to what we want to talk about FISA and the Investigatory Powers Act, which has been amended, I think, this week. And, you know, people's concerns about the DPDI bill and the kind of watering down of some of the requirements to obtain warrants, etc.
Yeah, you're quite right. And it was kind of refreshing, to be honest, to see an MP kind of, And I know there are some MPs that have, you know, kind of criticised the bill, but I don't know. It's not really something I've seen kind of frequently. So it was kind of refreshing to see, you know, that David Davis did slam department work and pensions kind of, you know, hope of being able to monitor. I think it's benefits or people on benefits, isn't it? Their bank accounts to kind of understand fraud. And, you know, it is, I think that's very invasive, isn't it? And I don't see how.
Well, it is if there's no justification. You know, if there's no justification, you're just going to indiscriminately investigate bank accounts. Or, you know, I would have thought they'd be using some kind of intelligence like AI to say, well, these people look like they might be committing fraud. Let's go and have a look at them. But maybe they are, maybe they're not.
Yeah, you're right. The devil's in the detail, isn't it? But I think I saw that it means that they'll be able to monitor 20 million accounts, which is, you know, just under a third of the population, isn't it, of the UK, which is a staggering amount. And obviously, take out, I'm not sure how many people there are that are 18 and under in the UK. So, you know, that number could even be more, couldn't it, than a third of the population if you're considering those 18 and above.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, that's, you know, we do complain about other, you know, jurisdictions where the, you know, governments and agencies, government agencies have got access, unfettered, or it would seem to be from what we read, unfettered access to personal data. But it's the same in every country, really, isn't it? The governments need to have some degree of access to information for security purposes. How far do you take, you know? But we complain about other jurisdictions, but I think it's just the same here, potentially.
Yeah, it is. And that's quite a nice segue, actually, isn't it, onto FISA, which is exactly what that is. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allows US security services to access people's data without prior authorization.
Yeah.
And it's actually recently in the news that Joe Biden has reauthorized the act, permitting warrantless surveillance of non-US persons outside the US for another 2 years. It stated that the legislative move, known as the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act, was passed by the Senate with a vote of 60-34 just before the existing authorization expired. Although the kind of, not issue I have here, but kind of what made me like think about was, what about the EU-US data privacy framework? Because I'm sure that this, the FISA, that I think it's section 702, isn't it, that allows you to do that. That was a sticking point, wasn't it, in granting the US, well, it's not granting the US adequacy, is it? But it's putting a framework in place for organizations to sign up to say that they've got adequacy. But I thought FISA was a big sticking point in that, and I thought they'd rectified it, but then...
Well, I think they rectified bits of it by having an independent adjudicator, regulator effectively, and some other mechanics in place. One of which might be that, you know, that, and I don't know, Joe, but one of which might be that, you know, if you're signed up to the privacy framework, the data protection framework, then maybe you have to get a warrant.
Right.
You know, to access data. Okay, we'd have to double check. I'm only putting it out there as a, well, maybe, but the two things aren't actually necessarily at odds with each other. There could be a mechanism within the data protection framework which would accommodate this.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so like a safeguard through the framework that if you signed up.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, but a lot of organizations signed up through the framework are private companies, you know, that there may well be, I can't remember the exemptions, but I think we said media is exempt, definitely, didn't we? But it could be that government's exempt from the data protection framework anyway. We'd have to check. I think they probably are, Joe, because I think that governments can transfer data to each other under the GDPR quite easily.
Right. Okay. Yeah, Peter's left a comment saying that it's to do with rights enforcement as well as snooping. And yeah, it's a good point. I think the sticking point wasn't only just around kind of the access through FISA, but I think it was quite a big issue, wasn't it?
And it was about not being able to exercise your rights and not having anybody to kind of arbitrate on your behalf. That they were, you know, areas that there have been remedies put in place for.
Yeah, there is kind of a adjudicator, isn't there, that now you can kind of go to help enforce. I'm not sure who they are, but yeah, that's definitely been put in place.
Yeah. But this week, the UK Investigatory Powers Bill, which is an amendment to the Investigatory Powers Act, the IPA, which we've talked about before, haven't we? We remember a few months ago we talked about it and the confusion between RIPA and IPA, and there's about three pieces of legislation we were trying to triangulate and get a fix on. But anyway, these kind of changes in this particular amendment are enabling the authorities to surveil targets by gathering internet connection records, for instance, allowing the investigator to determine, you know, who's connected to what services, which apps, what websites, what phone numbers they might have dialed, where they were at a particular time, you know, what they did. So this is new and an amendment to the Investigatory Powers Act. Similar in a way to what we've just discussed about FISA, except this is UK citizens as well as non-UK citizens. FISA seems to only apply to overseas people that are not the US citizens, the Foreign Intelligence Services Act, yeah.
So is this working its way through
Gone through
Parliament, is it? Oh, it's gone through.
Yeah. Got the King's nod of approval apparently this week.
Right. Okay. Well, that's out of curiosity, you don't suppose you know how long it's taken to kind of go through?
Oh, I don't know. It might be about half an hour, given the.
No, the only reason I was asking to see if we can kind of get some sort of maybe estimate as to how long it might take for the bill to come through, because I think, well, it's not nailed on, is it? But there's going to be a general election, I think, at some point, isn't there?
I read something about July, but that seems remarkably close. I don't think it'll be July, but what do I know?
No, well, they have to go out and do campaigns, don't they? Or is that not?
Yeah, they have to dissolve Parliament first, don't they, as well?
Yeah, and that would obviously bring issues. I presume, I'm not really very well versed in terms of politics and what that means, but I guess that means that the bill wouldn't be able to get, you know, nothing would be able to get passed through if Parliament was dissolved.
That's right, yeah, the whole calendar comes to a stop. But don't forget the DPDI bill has got a stay of execution. So in anticipation of there being a general election, there was a motion passed to mean that it would survive a dissolution of Parliament, get back onto the parliamentary calendar. I think it until, from memory, the 6th of December. So I think, right, you know, in anticipation of that happening, then there's been this motion to bring it back to life again after the general election.
Right. OK, that's really interesting, actually. Something else I kind of want to talk about is off the back of the ICO's battle with Experian. I'm sure we're all aware of it. We've spoken about it on here, haven't we, a number of times. The ICO appealed the decision, didn't they, because it wasn't in their favour. And then I think it's been nullified again, hasn't it, essentially?
Yeah. You're not going to like this, Joe.
Go on.
The Investigatory Powers Act first reading was the 8th of November. So it's taken November,
six
December,
months.
January, February, March. Yeah, April, May nearly. Yeah, 7 months, yeah, to get through.
That's really quick, really quick. I'm going to might have to do some research on that and kind of see, you know, was there any sort of sticking points? But I guess it's new legislation, isn't it? There's nothing really that
amendment
it's kind of
been, to. It's an amendment.
It's amendment.
To. Yeah.
Okay. And was the original one kind of like the amendments, like the DPI 20, bill has been amended
2016
to part one, or was it an actual law before?
It was a law before the Investigative Powers Act, I think, is 2016.
Right.
So okay. It's been amended a few times. This is just an amendment to that. So potentially much quicker to get through.
Right, yeah, as opposed to a whole new set of regulation.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about...
The ICO and Experian battle.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I was doing a terrible job of explaining it, so I'm not sure if you're any better, but they've been at
war,
haven't they? That's all right. I was just saying they've been at war, haven't they, for... a number of years. I think does it run back to 2020? I think it does.
I think it does, yeah.
Yeah, the ICO had issues around Experian and the way that I think it was to do with articles 13 and 14, you know, providing privacy information to data subjects. And there's been a battle of back and forth. ICO tried to, you know, enforce some sort of penalty, I think, on Experian. There was an appeal that came in that was in favour of Experian. The ICO then appealed that. And then I think it's been judged that they're still in favour of Experian. And that was a terrible job of explaining it, but I think that's the gist of it. And what I want to talk about is off the back of that, the Upper Tribunal has released some guidance on GDPR transparency requirements. And I just thought it might be kind of worth kicking it around in here and having a bit of a discussion about it. Because they mentioned that I think it's to do with more Article 14 as opposed to Article 13, but they kind of said that the requirements in that in those articles is just the basic minimum that organizations need to provide to the data subjects. Sorry, I've got a Vipex coming through my ear again. I've closed the window. I still don't know why it's coming through. Anyway, sorry, where was I? Yes, so the Upper Tribunal released some guidance on GDPR transparency requirements, saying that the requirements of Articles 13 and 14 is just the basic minimum that organizations need to provide data subjects, stating that it depends on the circumstances that more information may need to be provided to data subjects by organizations if they're to comply with the transparency principle under Article 5.1a of the GDPR. They said that,
Yeah, I was going to say, that's interesting. Carry on.
No, I've got Vipex is down my ear. Rob, please pick up if you're there. The Upper Tribunal said that the information shared with the data subject should achieve the specific outcomes of ensuring those people are aware of the risks, rules, safeguards and rights in relation to the processing of personal data and the specific purposes for which data is being processed. It acknowledged, though, that the GDPR does not prescribe exactly how to achieve that. Therefore, they stated that this will be the case, that will be from case by case basis and will be context specific and underpinned by considerations of proportionality.
Well, what's interesting is the old definition, you know, under the old definition of kind of privacy information, is kind of added in anything else that makes the processing fair. But that got taken out, didn't it, in the GDPR? Remember, that used to be in the old Data Protection Act.
I missed that. Vipex was ringing in my ear for two minutes.
You have to provide, you know, certain information that's set out in Article 13. But it used to say, and anything else which is necessary to make the processing fair, but it doesn't say that anymore. So it's quite prescriptive in what, you know, Article 13 and 14 says you have to provide. And without that kind of caveat and anything else, you'd say, well, why would we have to provide anything else? Well, now we're saying, oh, to make it transparent, you know, fairness, lawfulness and transparency being three separate and distinct things.
But why take it out if your guidance is still to do that? It just confuses me, and it kind of worries me more about kind of the DPDI bill as well. You know, they're taking things out and they'll probably still have that as their guidance, and yet people will probably miss it because it's not explicitly stated like that. You know, that added sentence at the end of in the old legislation, you know, why remove it if that's still what you consider to be Best practice, all the way you go about it.
Yeah, well, it's been taken out because it's been replaced by one word, transparency, and one concept of transparency, which is really broad, isn't it?
Yeah, and that just causes you to go and have to do more research, which, you know,
you have to test your privacy notices. You know, are they understood by the people whose data you're processing? You know, are they comprehensive? Are they accurate? Yeah, but what it was basically saying, I mean, the ICO basically challenged the ruling against them and Experian, challenged it and lost again. But what we're saying now is that, you know, this kind of formulaic approach to privacy notices, you know, it's fair if it's got this. And the recently ICO did comment on, it was a TikTok, wasn't it, where they said, you know, you're better off putting you need to put a table in with each lawful basis, or each processing purpose, each lawful basis, and the retention period. Yeah, so we have, I think, taken a formulaic approach to privacy information. We've got checklists and tick boxes, haven't we? Yeah, it's got that. Therefore, it's right. Now we're saying, no, that isn't necessarily the case. You know, you need to put yourself back into the shoes of the data subject to see if it's transparent enough.
Yeah. The Upper Tribunal said that data subjects should understand or should be aware of the risks, rules, safeguards and rights in relation to the processing of the personal data and the specific purposes for which data is being processed. So how do you demonstrate that? I mean, you demonstrate the rights by informing data subjects of the rights. That should be in there regardless, right?
Yeah, that's easy enough to do, yeah.
In terms of the risks, rules and safeguards, I think that might be a little bit trickier to demonstrate. And then could you then not argue that this is kind of contradicting if you start putting in, you know, tables of risks, safeguards and rules, for example? It's not particularly transparent, is it, the more you're kind of intertwining and adding things in?
Well, it becomes more difficult to understand. It might be more transparent, but it becomes potentially more difficult to understand and maybe relevant to a smaller subset of data subjects, depending, you know, some circumstances. And it could be that you're only doing certain processing activities on a smaller subset.
It
just makes it complicated, a bit more complicated.
I think so. And could, you know, is it feasible that you as an organization have to go through and provide risks for all the processing you do. If you're a massive organization and have, you know, thousands of processing activities within your organization, how on earth are you going to go through that and identify all of the potential risks?
Well, I'm going to have to read this judgment, because that's not what the GDPR says. You have to provide privacy information.
Well, yeah, they do say that, acknowledge that it doesn't, you know, prescribe exactly how to achieve it. But
you could arguably say Article 3014 is a starting point. It's the bare, you know, the minimum to provide. That I could accept that. But putting in a risk assessment table is, you know, how far do you take it? You know, there's a risk of an asteroid hitting the Earth today, you know, in 10 minutes time. What's the likelihood of that? Very, very low. So why are we putting in privacy information? You know, what point will you draw the line saying, well, this risk is so remote or such little impact, we're not going to put that in? Need a bit more clarity, don't we? Need to read through it, really, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. And if you flip it on the other side and you're looking at the processing that's high risk, well, you should be carrying out a data protection impact assessment for that anyway, which will highlight the risks. So I guess that will make it easier to pull it across. But I mean, if people really wanted to understand the risks of some of the processing and it was high risk, could you not just provide them with the DPIA?
Well, you could do. And we've seen that before, haven't we? We've asked for views of DPIAs from suppliers and they've provided them. In fact, we've been asked for a DPIA on something we were doing and we provided it because we'd done one.
I think that would make most sense, kind of maybe adding into your processing kind of a section for data protection impact assessments and have a list of your DPIAs. If people want to go access it, they can do.
Yeah. Your public authorities do. They've got DPIAs there to read.
Yeah, Steph just put a link in the chat saying still a good read. I'm not sure what it is.
So Guidelines on Transparency.
On oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, I'd have to say I haven't read this one for a long time, WP260, but I will reread it.
Yeah, thanks for that, Steph. I'll have to have a read of that myself as well.
Now, does it relate to Article 14 more than Article 13?
That was the impression I got, yes.
Yeah.
Simply because that data is coming from a third party, isn't it? And the data subjects probably aren't aware that their data is being disclosed from one organisation to another, although, you know, it should be, although it's listed in privacy policy, we may share. You're not actually aware, are you, until the data has been shared and then you've been contacted by the person who, or the organisation that's received your data.
Yeah. Actually, I got one out of the blue the other week, last week, I think. I got an email out of the blue with a privacy note saying, we've got your personal data. And, you know, here's privacy information. So I emailed it back, said, where did you get it from? I've not heard back from them yet. So you're reminding me to follow that up. But I was quite pleased to get that actually out of the blue.
I can't say I've ever had that, me, I don't think. It's not something I've come across. I check on my emails quite a bit. I'm not one of those people who has 20,000 unread emails on the phone. But I can't say I've ever noticed an organization reaching out to me and saying, we've got your data and this is what we're going to do with it.
I will dig it out and forward it on to you. Remind me.
Yes, please do. Moving on, shall we?
Yeah, now I had an interesting discussion with Esther yesterday. She's just finished an audit, data protection audit somewhere. And this is a company that runs business events, and they publish business newsletters and they do training. You know, so one of the courses and the events and things that they train on and deal with is, for instance, cybersecurity. Now, their target is business people. It's all entirely business to business. And so Esther rang me up and said, you know, they've got this issue about the PECA. So they're doing direct marketing, you know, to their user base, people who've either attended or been interested, expressed an interest in their events, training or newsletters. And, you know, they're working on the basis of a legitimate interest because it's B2B. But they often get private email addresses when people are signing up for the services, you know, and Esther was saying that definitely changes the goalpost because, you know, that's effectively an individual subscriber rather than a corporate subscriber, which is how the PECA characterizes it. So that was one thing that was like, I've got to kind of throw a few things out and come back to it. That was one thing. But then if you're exhibiting at one of their events, which happens, you know, this happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Then they share the data of the attendees with the exhibitors and the sponsors. And then they also contact those people, you know, on the basis of legitimate interest because it's B2B. So it seemed to me that the whole chain was kind of built on sand, really, you know, shifting sand. You know, they're talking about using the soft opt-in. Okay, so it's consumers, it's a soft opt-in. You know, they've attended an event, you know, it's a soft opt-in. Well, it makes me wonder how similar products and services are. So, you know, if you're attending a cybersecurity event, you know, is a data protection event similar? Or is cybersecurity training similar? You know, again, what is it we're looking at to determine is it similar? We really should put ourselves in the position of the data subject to say, yeah, that doesn't seem out of the ordinary. And that seems related too. So it kind of threw down quite a few challenges, really. And I checked out their privacy notice this morning, actually. It does say that they're working on the basis of legitimate interest, potentially some processing on the basis of a contract if you bought a ticket to an event, and potentially something on consent. But the other question that came up was, okay, so if we're relying on soft opt-in and we've had people's data for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and we didn't provide them with a privacy notice or thorough privacy notice at the very outset when we collected their data, what the ICO's view is that completely undermines your contact strategy, doesn't it? You're not allowed to. They fine people for saying, well, you didn't ask them this at the outset. But you're completely knackered. You can't do anything about that, can you? You can't go back in time, jump in your DeLorean and scoot back a couple of years and say, oh, just fill this in, would you? So, I mean, I think the ICO is wrong. I've always thought the ICO had been overzealous in their interpretation of the PECA. But on that score, let's say you've got people that you've been emailing every week for 2 years. You've got evidence, because you track it, that they've opened the emails, they've clicked on a few links, and they've never complained. Why is that a problem? You know, they're obviously interacting with your communications, and you're giving them a facility to opt out, and they're not choosing to opt out. Why would that be a problem if you hadn't asked them the question 2 years ago?
And
I just don't think it's right.
Are you relying on legitimate interest, are you here? Sorry, or consent?
Legitimate interest or consent. You know, either way, you know, if you've got this ongoing relationship with somebody, but you failed to ask them the right question or phrase it wrongly or bundled consent or some misdemeanor, you know, when you first collected it, why is that a problem when they are clearly in interacting with your brand?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it probably comes down to, well, with consent doesn't last forever, does it? And you should refresh your consent. Well, there's no real guideline, is there? It depends on what you're doing. But I think I've seen before that the ICO says roughly every 2 years. So I guess you could argue that if you're sending out these emails to these people and they're not purchasing anything, but is that what you said? You said they're not purchasing anything, but they're interacting.
No, they are buying. Let's say they've attended an event, a cybersecurity event, and then you in signing up the event, you're agreeing to the terms and conditions. One of the terms and conditions is that we're going to email you, you know, B2B type of stuff, which is what it says in the privacy notice. And then you get emails. And you keep getting emails for every 2 years, and you think they're really good, you know, like Lexology or, you know, Mondac or this Freevesty, you know, and you read them and you use them in this, for instance, and you click on them. You know, the fact you didn't get proper consent 2 years ago when you signed up to that, why would that be, should that be a problem?
I don't think it is a problem, isn't it? For you. I know that's not really what you're looking for. You're after an answer.
No, not at all. No, I'm throwing it out there. Not from you, Joe. I'm not testing you, Joe. I'm just throwing it out there as something to think about. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've got it wrong. But I just think that the rules are very tight, aren't they? And we've seen the ICO fine people for not asking the right question when they first collect the data. Anyway, it was interesting. So Esther was kind of saying, well, you know, what should we do about it? So, well, you know, you've got to report what your findings and kind of the degree of compliance of your findings. But, you know, if we were going to offer a solution, we might. So you're not allowed to email to ask for consent, according to ICO. Again, that's a little bit bonkers in my view. But what you could do is email and ask for a business address for anybody you've got a private address for, potentially. And then, you know, you're trying to then repopulate your database over the course of a year, for instance, with business data, not private emails. But I might want to use my private email address. I might be a contractor, I might be hopping around between companies, I might be moving jobs quite regularly, and therefore using my Gmail account might be infinitely better for me as a person than using my dataprotectspeople.com account. I just think the rules are very tight, is all I'm flagging. And it came up in an audit this week.
Yeah, they are very tight, and it's quite a tricky thing to kind of navigate through you know, the interpretation of whether someone is a corporate subscriber or an individual subscriber. And it goes back to the LinkedIn kind of conundrum, doesn't it, around, you know, are people on LinkedIn for personal use or professional use? Because they sign up with probably their personal email, but the purpose of using it is in a professional capacity. And
yeah, but this is where we live into it. It's not necessarily black and white.
No, it's not.
Nothing's black and white.
We've spoken about LinkedIn on here before, haven't we? And I'm sure someone's mentioned before that LinkedIn kind of has in their terms that for you signing up to LinkedIn is you consenting to the people on there, reaching out to you, promoting to you, perhaps trying to recruit you for other organisations. But then to me, that's not valid consent, because why is LinkedIn collecting consent on behalf of the data controller that's using LinkedIn as the platform to send out the promotional material?
Mm.
But, yeah, you know, what do we know?
It's an interesting one. It's interesting. But on the subject of the PECA, or the PECR, as some people call it, we've been working on cookies, haven't we, Joe, which has been quite an interesting project. And the key things that we've found from doing the cookie audits is that nobody has got any degree of control over what's going on, or any degree of understanding. You know, the people we're talking to who are, you know, digital marketing people or web developers, whatever. There's no real mechanism for approving the use of cookies. There's no real mechanism for managing them, you know, and there's seems to be a huge lack of understanding of what they actually are performing, what they're actually doing, what data are they collecting, what data are they writing, what is being read, where is it going? And that's, I'm sure it's not them. But what's worrying is the ICO has got this AI, or developing the AI tool. They are going to get every website. Every website, aren't they? Because they've got an AI tool. If it's a decent AI tool, it'll catch everything. If it doesn't catch everything, it's not a decent tool.
No. And it's, yeah, you're right in terms of it's going to come very prevalent, isn't it, across, you know, as you said, every organization, because they are clamping down on cookie compliance. And I think something that I've kind of probably observed from this project is that not only do people kind of not understand, you know, what I don't think people actually understand what cookies are on their pages. That's what
But we've been,
and they're,
you know,
ones, well, they're not always the ones placing it, are they? Because third parties can place it, but
yeah, but the tools that we've been, or the client's been using to screen, you know, look at their websites and produce reports for us, again, then they don't seem that reliable. We've had different results back every time the system's been run, different number of pages scanned. You know, it might be the configuration that's wrong rather than the actual tool. Different cookies back. We've got privacy notice was listing cookies that aren't on the site. We've got cookies on the site that aren't on the privacy notice, and the privacy notice is meant to be published by the tool. So the whole thing is like, God, how on earth is this working?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to be working. And we've got a database of 30 million cookies on this scanning tool, but it hasn't got obvious ones that we can find definitions for. On Google and using ChatGPT and on other people's websites. So I'm just wondering, I don't know if anybody's got any really good cookie scanning tools, but what we've been working with has been, I think, very uninspiring.
I agree. Yeah, that's probably a question. There we go. Oh, no, cookie cat categorization, herding cat, Steph. To be honest, Steph, it was more of a question for you specifically. We know you deal with cookies, but if you do use a tool for scanning cookies, or anyone else that's listening, please do reach out, because I think it's a service that we're going to start offering, isn't it, moving forward, kind of a review of organizations' cookies.
We've done a few of them, and everyone needs to do it. If we can find a really simple, efficient way of doing what we need to do, which really is, you know, have we got the list of cookies? Do we know what, you know, we've got a management regime over cookies? Have we got a list of cookies that have been applied to the website? Can we demonstrate what they do? And then can we give people control of which cookies are placed or not? That's really the requirement in a nutshell, isn't it? If we've got a really good tool that can do that, great. But we haven't found one yet.
No, Laura's left a comment saying that she had a really interesting conversation last year with a web developer. They advised her to speak with to the legal team or the DPO about cookies, because they would know how to make it compliant.
Right.
Laura is the DPO, and I mean, there's only so much a DPO can actually do, right? Because without actually knowing what the cookie is and what it does, it's hard to categorize it as functional, performance, and strictly necessary. Yeah. And knowing what the cookie does then allows you to ensure that, you know, you're either collecting consent or relying on legitimate interest to place those cookies. So it's both side of it, isn't it? It's both.
Yeah, it
the
is.
DPO, I mean, and the web developers.
Yeah, but when you reached out to some of the companies whose cookies were being placed, again, you got some really good responses, didn't you? You know, engaged, helpful. They do this. Yeah. You know, great. You know, that's what we need to know. We need to know what they do so we can put it in the information to inform the users correctly. But other companies were like drawing a blank, weren't they?
Yeah, and it's quite daunting, isn't it, when organizations themselves have these cookies on their site and they don't know what they do. If you don't know what your cookie does, why is it on your website? And I know that's probably easy for me to say, but surely you'd understand, or you'd have to.
Steph's got the answer.
Steph, hopefully. Yeah.
Steph's got his hand up. Oh, here he is.
I haven't shaved.
neither have I.
Yeah, me neither.
Hold me papers about this.
Yeah, no. I think the problem comes down to, and sorry, this is phraseology. If you go on most websites, they've got what they call a cookie policy. They haven't. They have a cookie notice, and they don't have a cookie policy. You're mopping up the floor.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing. You need to control the stuff that comes onto your website, and that comes down to tag governance and understanding why you've got the functionality you've got on your site. And what I mean by that is that you've got people set their cookie policy. They let anybody set cookies which are able to read across multiple sites. And websites these days are made up of multiple servers. And if you don't have a cookie policy and actually apply your cookie policy, this is why I say cookie categorization. If you look at something like the _GA cookie and you go to the different databases, it's categorized as a performance cookie on some, it's categorized as an advertising cookie on some, and it's categorized as a analytics cookie by some. So it's surprising. It's actually 13 years coming up on the 25th of May since the PECA regulation came in the UK, and we still haven't got a we've got a teenager that we still can't control or understand.
It's a good point. There's really good points in there, Steph, particularly about the policy and the notice. That is a really good observation. The policy generally is, wild west out there with cookies, and the notice is just a way of, you know, trying to show people. But we found the same. We found the same cookie described in different ways on different tools and forums.
Yeah, and the problem we've got, Phil, is that because you're using technology without any controls over the suppliers, if the suppliers change their technology and don't inform you, they can change the underlying technology that you've put onto your website. And it comes down to the fact that, you know, we use this phrase controller. Are you really a controller if you can't control the cookies that the third party is setting?
Again, good points. Very good points. Do you have a good? I mean, somebody's saying in the chat that the ICO is developing a cookie scanning tool, which would be great. Have you got a good tool that you use for this type of purpose?
There's a variety of tools that I utilize for looking at the relevant sites, but a lot of this comes down to not the cookies, but the servers that are being supported. And so you would have seen last year that I presented something on this slightly, it's privacy space with sensitive websites, which are leaking personal data through these tags. You know, you've got people who set up technology and without being unfair on web developers, I was looking at this the other day, data protection is not taught on web design courses.
It's not taught on law courses.
And, you know, I find that what has happened is that websites have evolved from the brochure sites from 2012 when the legislation 2011 and 2012 when the legislation came in, so they do a lot more, and that's where I think, again, you're back into phraseology of what is anonymous, what is anonymized, what is pseudonymous, and what is personal data.
Yeah, very good, all good stuff.
I recently did a presentation for this for the British Computer Society, and I'm quite happy to share the link with you guys so you can share it if you wish. So,
Oh, yeah, that'd be useful to have a go. I've just written down websites leaking personal data. Is that something you've published then, Steph?
Sorry, say that again.
Websites leaking personal data. Is that something you, a paper you've published, did you say?
It was a report that was in The Guardian last July about Meta, at least, predominantly about Meta, but it's an ongoing issue and you'll find it on a lot of charity websites. The problem happens, Phil, is that most websites aren't designed. Most websites are templates that are copied from another site. So you might have a piece of technology on a retail site, which is useful for e-commerce, and you can say that's fantastic. But then if you use the same template for a service that is providing support for vulnerable victims, and you're collating that information, you've got to ask yourself why you're collating it.
Yeah, so there could be code code embedded in that template that you're not really aware what it's doing.
Yeah, and there's also changes in technology in terms of event-based tracking. Event-based tracking is becoming more frequent with a lot of the technology providers, so that you're tracking not just page views, you're tracking when people click on outbound links. That's often got sensitive personal data in it.
Yeah. And that's that. I guess that's where web beacons come in, isn't it? I suppose you click on a button, it's still flagging up that you know you clicked on that button.
Yeah, and a beacon, you know, a pixel, a GIF. They're effectively what they are doing is they're providing a link to a third party server, and that third party server, once you've made that link to that server, if you don't have a cookie policy that means that that can't read some of the cookies or write some of the cookies, you end up with this issue of, you know, you'll find that cookie categorization tools, what they do is once a month they go and scan the website, and you know, if a new cookie comes in and they only scan part of that website, you're not going to get a complete picture anyway.
Yeah, all right, great stuff. Well, thank you for that. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thanks, Steph. We've only got a few minutes left, Phil, and I have got something to add to this cookie kind of conversation that we're having. And as part of, you know, completing the cookie audit, I had to review a cookie statement, should I say, rather than a policy. And obviously, I did a bit of digging on the Pecker to have a look, you know, what's actually required on a cookie statement. And it doesn't really go into too much detail, does it? It kind of just says clear and comprehensive information about the purpose of what the cookie does. So I went and had a look to kind of see, you know, guidance on clear and comprehensive. And I came across some ICO guidance that said that clear and comprehensive is not defined in the Pecker, but Article 5.3 of the e-privacy directive, which is where the Pecker comes from, says that clear and comprehensive information should be provided in accordance with data protection law. This relates to the UK GDPR's transparency requirements and the right to be informed. It means that when you set cookies, you must provide the same kind of information to users and subscribers as you would do when processing their personal data. So to me, that says that in your cookie statement, it should have everything that a privacy policy has around international transfers, data retention, third parties it's going to,
so on.
But it's not. Never in a cookie statement, is it?
No, and then your cookie statement, you've got 200. I mean, some of these sites got hundreds of cookies, haven't they? Your statement's going to get unmanageable. But how you read that out, that I would say, yeah, it sounds like that's
right
what they're requiring. And then if you fold into that what you mentioned earlier about the upper tier tribunal decision about transparency, all of a sudden you've got risk assessments in there, and I'm going to change job, Joe. I'm just going to become a privacy notice writer.
And before you know it, a cookie statement becomes a couple of pages with 100 cookies onto a 100-page document that lists God knows what.
That nobody can read.
Yeah. No, that isn't transparent because it's got a million words on it and it's no longer clear and comprehensive, not easy to digestible, and you're still infringing the law.
Exactly. Now then, what are you doing next week? You got anything? Oh, bank holiday, isn't it? Bank holiday Monday.
Bank holiday Monday. So I'm off out Saturday, Sunday in Leeds. Off to a festival. I am. Yeah. Not one that you'll know, unfortunately, I don't think. Any younger listeners, I'd have thought. Miles is aware of it. It's called Mint Festival.
The Mint Festival. I'm going to that. Actually, one of my nieces is going to that.
Is she really?
Yeah, she's asked for some tickets off my brother.
Are you pulling my leg? Are you being serious?
No, no. Serious, yeah.
Well, I might have a look for...
It was on the family WhatsApp, it was. Anyway, I was going to go, but now Ellie's going, I'm not going to go.
No, well, Lynn said, well, Joe, we know it will be wet. I know, it's a bloody shame, isn't it? I think it used to be in September and they moved it to May, hoping that it's going to be sunny, but Rishi hasn't turned the weather on yet, has he? So it's still grey and, well, it's warmer now than what it has been for the past month. But yeah, fingers crossed it stays dry, but I highly doubt that. What about you? How's your week looking all weekend? Are you off sailing?
I might do on Sunday, I don't know, it's weather dependent. And then next week, work-wise, I've got to finish off some training for the Jamaican Data Protection Act, you know, series of training to help everyone get their staff up to training. Because time is marching on 1st of June when, you know, the ICO over there has said it's coming into effect, is rapidly approaching. They haven't managed to publish out the mechanism for doing the registration particulars yet, which again is leaving it really tight, you know. 3 weeks to go. 4 weeks.
Yeah,
ago.
Well, you have to, is it that you have to submit all the processing you do? Is it monthly you have to submit?
No, there's an annual return, 31st of March every year you got to submit what they call a data protection impact assessment, a DPIA. But rather than keeping ROPAs, in Jamaica they have a register and it keeps pretty much the same information on the register, public register, as we controllers have to keep and processors have to keep on our ROPAs. So I think it's a better mechanism.
Well, who knows? Maybe we'll start taking bits from Jamaican data protection law.
Well, but there's lots in there that's very good. Anyway, that's what I'll be doing. I think a couple of days next week, just finishing that off. Then I've got some other bits and pieces to do.
Sounds like a good week to me. And on that note, as it's 32 minutes past one, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. We will be back next week. I believe it will be Information Rights Part 2, because Jasmine penciled in part two at the back end of part one. We will see you next week. Have a good bank holiday weekend.
Have a great weekend.
And we'll see you then.
And thanks everyone for your time.